Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
I'm one of the Writer's Block team, Bobby Jean Bell, and we just heard, did you recognize that? A little bit of Herb Alpert's Whipped Cream, and it starts us out tonight. I'm so delighted that you're here with us, and I am happy that my co-pilot tonight is author and good friend Richard Polinelli. Hey, Richard, where are you calling from?
I am still stuck in stormy Omaha, Nebraska, so we're out here in the Midwest, and actually it wasn't too bad, but we'll see. Every day is a different adventure here.
You say stormy, so have you got bad weather tonight?
Well, not tonight, but boy, this morning about 5 o'clock, we got an early alarm wake up from Mother Nature. So it was interesting for a while.
Wow. Well, I'm so glad that you're here, and I know that both of you and I want to send out a big howdy to our host, Jim Christina, who isn't able to be with us tonight, but I bet he's listening. So, hi, Jim. And we also want to say hello to our bookie, Jerry Christina, who is a slender guest, very first guest on the line, Henry Park, film reviewer for True West magazine. He's calling in with his Henry's Western Roundup report. Hey, Henry, how are you?
Bobby, I'm fine, thank you. How are you doing?
Really good. Glad to have you with us tonight. So tell us, what's happening in the real R-E-E-L West?
Well, we've actually got some good new Western stuff to watch now and more in the offing. Season 7 of The Cowboy Way, the reality show that follows three Alabama cowboy cattlemen, Bubba, Booger, and Cody, is now running on INSP. It's still on Wednesday nights, but they made one big change for you binge-watching types. The entire season, in fact, all 7 seasons, are available right now for free on INSP.com and on YouTube.
Oh, wow.
Personally, I'm not a big binge-watcher. I like to savor a good show and not run through it too fast. How about you, Bobby?
Well, I go back and forth. The thing about binge-watching is you start to realize how much sort of repetition there is when you don't have a week in between. We love Blue Bloods. We love Blue Bloods. And we'll watch like 4 or 5 at a time. And it's like, oh, here we go again. You know, Aaron and you know, you just, it's like you really can feel the template that's used, where if it's a week apart, you don't notice that quite the same way.
I noticed that. Actually, reading Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes short stories, when I'd read a collection, boy, would the plots start to become very similar. So I taught myself to read one at a time because otherwise I anticipated too much. But
Good point.
October, a new limited series is coming to Showtime, The Good Lord Byrd, about abolitionist John Brown, played by Ethan Hawke. Brown, of course, was trying to start a slave revolt and led an attack on the armory at Harper's Ferry, Virginia. Ethan Hawke must love Westerns and historical stories. He did White Fang in 91, In a Valley of Violence, The Ghastly Magnificent Seven remake, and no, that's not the actual title. It should have been, but not for his work. He was excellent, but anyway. He played Pat Garrett in last year's The Kid, and he developed Good Lord Byrd from the novel. By the way, did you ever see Raymond Massey play John Brown in Santa Fe Trail?
I can't say that I have.
I don't think I have.
What about you, Richard?
Oh.
No, I haven't.
If Jim's listening, he's shaking his head up and down like, yeah, I remember that.
Oh, I bet. If you go to the roundup, I have a link to a good clip from the ending of it. They wanted him to seem crazy, and they fitted Massey with solid black contact lenses. It was quite an effect, but poor Massey couldn't see a thing with them on, so it was a real challenge. Now, Bobby, you and I were just talking yesterday about losing John Saxon, fine actor who started in Westerns in 1960 with John Huston's The Unforgiven, followed it with Posse from Hell, both with Audie Murphy. He's wonderful opposite Brando in Appaloosa. Do you have a favorite John Saxon Western?
I don't, but you know, I didn't really remember much about him until he passed. And then I was reading some of the obits and I went and looked at some of the things he'd been in. And, you know, he's another one of those guys that you suddenly realize, oh, he was like in everything.
Right.
You know,
I remember we were talking about how many fine Western actors we've lost over the past week or so. And then I had to go because Earl Holliman was calling, wanting to talk about actress Jacqueline Scott, who had just passed away. Mm-hmm. She did a great Gunsmoke with Earl. She did 8 Gunsmokes, 5 Have Gun Will Travels, 5 or 6 movies for Don Siegel. And she was the lead in the pilot for The Wide Country, the Western series that Earl did with Andrew Prime as Rodeo Cowboys. And Earl recalled that John Saxon and Andrew Prime were doing a show in Hawaii. They went swimming, and John was a strong swimmer. But he went out too far, got caught in a riptide, and was being dragged out to sea. Andrew grew up in Florida, was on the swim team at school, and he knew from riptides. He got John to swim alongside him and got him back to land. And after that, Saxon always introduced Prime as the man who saved his life.
Okay.
Now, journalist Pete Hamill died yesterday. And I wonder how many remember that, you know, back in 1974, he wrote the script for the very controversial revisionist Western Doc, starring Stacy Keach as Doc Holliday and Faye Dunaway as Kate. With Faye, it was not Big Nose Kate. I was discussing it with Stacy Keach recently, and he loved playing Holliday, loved Pete Hamill's script. He said it had a prologue with Doc in whiteface on top of a butte playing solitaire and talking directly to camera, and an epilogue with him dancing. But the studio made them cut it out. They said it was just too weird and surreal. And it does kind of sound it.
Oh, how interesting. Yeah.
Well, now, one problem, of course, with revisionist Westerns is that they're really not about what they're supposed to be about. Stacy told me, and I'll give you his words. He said, "But I'll never forget the day just before we were getting ready to shoot the gunfight at the OK Corral. Director Frank Perry coming into my dressing room, very excited. And he said, 'I know what the show is about. It's about Vietnam.' I said, 'What?' 'It's about the abuse of young people.' 'Okay. And what difference does that make in terms of my performance?' You know, it didn't make any difference."
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Oh, and Olivia de Havilland, she died at 104. Mm-hmm. The very last of the great stars of Hollywood's golden years, last survivor of Gone with the Wind, besides some of the children. She starred in 3 terrific Westerns with Errol Flynn, Dodge City, They Died With Their Boots On, and the aforementioned Santa Fe Trail, with Flynn playing Jeb Stuart in that. And do you know what future president played George Armstrong Custer?
Was it Ronald Reagan?
It was not Bill Clinton, like you probably thought.
I was going to guess Barack Obama, but what do I know?
So close, and yet so far. Now, in my current roundup, I review the video release of a fine Western Olivia did with Alan Ladd, The Proud Rebel. That was a late one from 1958. And like Santa Fe Trail, it was directed by the great Michael Curtiz, who brought you Casablanca and Mildred Pierce and so many. It was their 10th film together, but with an 18-year gap. And Olivia was stunned that Curtiz requested her because she thought Curtiz hated her. And you can read all about that and so much more at www.henryswesternroundup.blogspot.com.
Thank you, Henry. It's always great to hear from you, and we'll talk to you next month.
I can't wait. Have a great show.
Our featured guest tonight is Kathleen M. Rogers, and we'll be chatting about her recently published book, The Flying Cutterbucks. But before we bring her on, let's take a listen to Angel Flight by Darden Smith.
ever wanted to do was fly. Leave this world and live in the sky. I'll lift the C-130 out of Fort Worth town. I'll go up some days I don't wanna come down. I'll fly that plane, call the angel.
Welcome back to the Writer's Block. Let me tell you a little something about tonight's guest, Kathleen M. Rogers. She's a novelist whose work has appeared in Family Circle magazine, Military Times, and anthologies. Now, last time she was with us, we spoke about her third novel, Seven Wings to Glory, that deals with racism and war and won an honorable mention for war and military in the 2017 Forward Indies Book of the Year Awards. Her previous two novels, Johnny Come Lately and The Final Salute, were both critically acclaimed. She and her husband, Tom, a retired U.S. Air Force fighter pilot, commercial airline pilot, live in a suburb of North Texas. We are so delighted to have you with us tonight, Kathleen. I know Richard and I can't wait to start talking about your book. Welcome to the Writer's Block.
Thank you so much for having me. And I love both songs that were played. Whipped Cream, I'm staring at that iconic album cover with that, you know, beautiful girl covered in whipped cream. I listened to that while I wrote one of the chapters. I love that. And then the song you just played, Angel Flight, that gave me goosebumps. I picked up my book, The Flying Cutter Books, and I thought I better start not bawling right now. I have to go and talk. But and interestingly enough, the song was written around an actual flight. And by God, we know one of the pilots, Jason Mars. He was flying for the Guard at the time and flying that C-130 with fallen warriors coming home. You had no idea of my ties to that with my old neighbor, Jason Mars.
No, I didn't. I heard that
awesome.
Song. I heard that song last night on a radio station a friend of mine has in Texas. And I sent him a message right away, and I said, "What is that song? I have to have that song for tomorrow night."
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's
and
just awesome!
He gave mm-hmm. me the information. So we are so delighted to have you, Richard. Why don't you say hello to Kathleen?
Hey, Kathleen, how you doing?
Hi, Richard. I haven't got to talk to you on the Writer's Block since I believe it was 2017.
Yeah,
September. Yeah.
Yeah,
we did a 2-hour show that night.
we definitely did. It was an interesting show because of who all had called in and who was in the studio that night. It was really a great show, and it's great to have you back on where I could be on and talk to you about your book. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the Flying Cutter Books and how you came to create this incredible story?
Okay, I'll just set it up. So early 2017, I signed with my new agent, Diane Nine, president of Nine Speakers Incorporated. And when I signed with her, I had this idea for a story, but I was pretty nervous about it because I told her that I wanted to set up the story against the background, the 2016 presidential election. And Diane said, go for it. And so I did. It's the bravest and boldest piece I've ever written. Then the publisher came on board later on. You know, it always takes a while. And that's Wyatt McKenzie, and the publisher's Nancy Clary. And she had a vision. And what we did is I wrote an additional chapter. We changed the title to The Flying Cutter Books because it's all part of the story. And if I could just read the deal announcement in Publishers Marketplace sums up the book. The Flying Cutter Books was pitched as a serving of fried green tomatoes set against the backdrop of presidential elections for the Me Too and She Persists generation. The story centers on a Gold Star family of a fighter pilot Missing in Action in Vietnam and the Women He Left Behind. It exposes the collateral damage of war, sexual assault, racism, elections, patriarchies, and false patriotism, while supplying the satisfaction of action, resistance, and a strong female cast fight against oppression. In essence, The Flying Cutter Books explores the fierce love and loyalty of a family of women over generations.
Yeah, I mean, that sums up that book pretty good, I think, actually. And I was going to ask you, because you brought up that you were a little nervous, apprehensive, you know, putting the book out there. And I was mm-hmm. I was going to ask you, were you concerned that because of the fact that you were kind of dabbling in what was going on in the political election at the time, were you concerned that maybe that might be too much for some people and it would turn people away? Or what was that the apprehension? Was there something else at play before you put that book out?
Thank you, Richard, for asking the question. Now I can put the needle in the balloon and I can go, oh, now I can relax.
There you go.
Yes.
Let's get that elephant out of the room right now.
Yeah, okay. So that's the big elephant in the room. Yes, I was very concerned because, quite frankly, when my first novel, The Final Salute, debuted in 2008, a lot of my readers were military. I had about half were men, half were women. And people started knowing me as the military author. Although, quite frankly, I've written about everything. But the fact that I'm an old military wife, turned military mom, and I've had a son go to war, so I've lived through all that. But, you know, I know how my military family feels about patriots around our shoulders and say, we're patriots. My family sacrificed for this country. So I decided all my novels have dealt with military families. I was hoping this novel would not go military, but you know what? The harder I tried to get away from the subject, it came back to haunt me. And when I realized that Trudy, my protagonist, when I realized her father was a fighter pilot missing in action, I resisted for a while because I thought, I've already written about fighter pilots. I wrote about them for Military Times. I've written about them and actually in Family Circle magazine because my husband was a fighter pilot. I've written about them in The Final Salute. But when that story, when the plot started coming to me in that aspect, then I felt like I'd come home. I knew I had my framework. Then you throw in strong women, activism, sexual assault, a presidential candidate who grabbing, you know, women without their consent, then I'm like, okay, here we go.
Yeah.
It made
sense for you to use that considering what the two sisters and the aunt had gone through. And as the book progresses, we learn more and more about what actually happened. So to use that to kind of trigger the story that was to come was an excellent, you know, use of a little setting up for the plot for it. So it made sense to do that. And I like you, you know, I was just curious if you were concerned that maybe some people would go a little too far overboard and just go, well, I'm not going to read this because it's doing that. So mm-hmm. It sounds like you guys kind of plowed right through it. So let's now we've chased the elephant out of the room.
Thank you, Richard. I love that. And Richard, thank you also for reading the book. I know Bobby Jean did, but thank you, Richard.
Well, you're welcome. It was a good book to read. And it was interesting that you picked 1974 as far as the events that impacted this family so greatly, because they're mm-hmm. 72 there. I think it was 72. Their dad is shot down. 74, yes. the youngest, the only son in the family dies, and then there's a cousin who dies. For me, 74, when I think back to 74, was an equally crappy year. So I kind of was relating to this family, what they were going through. Yeah, I had an uncle and a grandfather die within 4 months of each other. So I'm thinking, I'm right there with you guys. I know what's going on.
Wow.
I can, it was really well done. And I just was kind of curious
to,
you know, what got you to tell this story this way. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what happened to the Clutterbucks? And I'm going to blame you if I say Clutterbucks because you put this in the book.
I know she put it a couple ways.
So if I oops and say Clutterbucks, it's your fault. But why don't you tell us a little bit about Trudy and how the family got to the point where we picked them up in the book?
Okay, Trudy. I wanted to also explore having a female protagonist that's a certain age. Not, you know, I've been all ages up until I'm almost 62, and I'm happy to be turning 62, especially in a pandemic. God, please let me turn 62. And all of us on here to survive this horrible time. But so Trudy is about, what, almost 58 when the story opens. She has just taken an early retirement from Southwest Airlines. She was the flight attendant. She started flying back in the 70s, Richard, when, you know, those Southwest stewardess wore hot pants and go-go boots. You know, that was back in that day. And she has left Dallas. She sold her condo. Her dog, her only family member that she claims there in Texas is her dog, Skylar. And Skylar's no longer with us. So Trudy is going to come home to Pardon, New Mexico, and help her elderly mother, Jewel, clean out the family home. And Jewel Clutterbucks, Jewel's been collecting mementos and souvenirs, things that mean something to her from the past. And in some ways, the house is frozen in that time, mm-hmm. especially around her late husband, Shep, who's still missing in action, and their son, who was Shepherd Clutterbuck Jr., if you will, but his nickname was Bogey, and that's a fighter pilot, a flight term. There's a lot of flight or pilot terms used in the book and aviation themes. And then Trudy has a little sister, Georgia, who's a couple of years younger. And then the family matriarch, if you will, is Star Hearn. That's Aunt Star. She's 81 when the story opens, and she's a retired nurse. And she's kind of the family caretaker. And the story opens October 2016. Yes, it opens the same day in real life that the Access Hollywood tape was all over the news. And I set my story. I dropped big, you know, national, international news items, and how it would affect or trigger certain things in this family of women. And so that's how the story opens up there and unfolds. And then, you know, well, what happened to Shep? His name is on the Vietnam Wall in Washington, D.C., but they never recovered a body. So that's part of the story. And then you have a young life cut out at age 11 with the other male in the family. And there's a lot of memories that Trudy, it's all told through her viewpoint. But I'm hoping that Shep and Bogey come alive for the reader just through Trudy's memory, the family, the way family they remember memories. Their loved ones. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Before we get into the next question, if you don't mind, Richard and Kathleen, maybe this would be a great time to hear a little bit about our host, LA Talk Radio.
Hi, Jim Christina, your host for The Writer's Block, right here on LA Talk Radio. And this is just a reminder that while everybody's locked down with this COVID-19, working from home, getting bored, you do have an option, and that option is to go to www.latalkradio.com. See, as a .com, we've got it all, from music, sports, self-help. Hell, we even have talk. So why don't you tune in during the day while you're working and listen to what our great hosts and great shows have to say. And just a reminder, Thursday night, 7 p.m. Pacific, is the Writer's Block, brought to you by LA Talk Radio. So have yourselves a great time, stay safe out there, and remember, latalkradio.com.
Thank you. a taste of honey from whipped cream
it.
And other delights. We're back with that.
I'm dancing in my chair.
Yeah, it's a good thing we don't have Skype cameras on right now.
Oh,
that would be embarrassing.
We could play Love Potion number 9.
I have to just say, thank you for all of how you've set us up with so much great information. I was enthralled with this book from page one. I savored every line. So it always takes me a long time to read when I'm reading that way. Your characters are, you give us so much depth within the characters, including the animals. Music and animals and landscape of New Mexico. We go to Las Vegas, New Mexico. These things that we go out to that airfield where Trudy's dad had originally flown from. You take us to these places and I'm there. You put us there. So there's a scene I'm choosing this music tonight because there's a scene with a stereo. You want to just tell us a little bit about that? My dad, we had that same kind of console. Tell us a little bit about that scene, maybe.
Oh, that scene, I believe, I think that's chapter 22. Yes, it's chapter 22, and it's called Dancing with the Three-Legged Dog. That is where a lot of the music from Herb Alpert and Tijuana Brass, I had so much fun. My husband, you know, got on Amazon, ordered the CDs for me, and it, because we couldn't find cover. My oldest son thought he took it because he grew up with this iconic, you know. That scene... What I did is Trudy's there, and you remember when everyone, I mean, you were styling, we didn't have it, but a lot of my friends did, my Aunt Kay in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Bobby Jean, where you live. I love that you're in New Mexico tonight. Do you remember the console, the stereo units where you'd, that's back when everybody had big color TV, and that it was a piece of furniture.
It was. We had a Magnavox. It was a piece of furniture.
Yeah. So like I would still call it a record player, but obviously that's not. So your stereo system, and Trudy uncovers that, and you know, she's sprucing up. Jewel, her mother's going through old photographs because Trudy's there to try to help mom declutter. And while Jewel is looking at old photographs, Trudy pulls out the iconic cover of the girl on, you know, whipped cream and other delights. And then because we find out the stereo can't be used. Trudy gets out. What can you do in 2000? This was 16. She gets out her smartphone and finds the playlist. And that's how we've got the iconic album cover propped up there. And then we've got the music coming out of Trudy's phone. It's basically just a very plain scene of grown daughter and elderly mother and a dog named Zia. But oh my gosh, there's so much that goes on.
There is.
In that scene. Every scene that a writer writes, every character, every piece that you place there has to have a job. If it doesn't have a job, then you need to take it out of the story. It's just a fluff or it's a waste. So I'm always careful how. And I'll just throw it out there for any writers out there that are listening or that have that dream, or you're struggling right now with your manuscript or you want to write that novel. This is my fourth novel. For years, I wrote for magazines. Writing does not come easy for me. It is hard. I have a love-hate relationship with writing, and yet I can't stop it. And I don't write one draft and go back and revise. I revise as I go. I'm a slow wheel turning. That is my process, but it's what works for me. Other writers find their own process. You just have to trust your process.
Yeah, and I think a lot of writers would agree with you that they have a love-hate relationship with this. You know, a lot of people call it a gift, call it a curse. And I tell this when new writers approach me, they'll ask me, you know, what's the first piece of advice that I would give them is, don't do this unless this is the only thing you can see yourself doing. And that if you were to stop doing it, there would be no purpose mm-hmm. to your life. Mm-hmm. If you are that committed to it, do it. But, you know, in other words, otherwise, save yourself. Go find something else, because this is not an easy thing to do, is to sit down and put together a novel, even a short story. It's not the easiest process in the world to fight through and put together. And then you have to put it out there and hope and pray everybody likes it, and that you don't get the slings and arrows of the negative reviews too much. So, yeah, it's really a love-hate relationship, I think, for all of us.
And Richard, you put it so beautifully. And I believe before you became a novelist, professional novelist, your background was journalism, print journalism, correct?
Yeah, I spent about 25 to 30 years as a sports writer and doing some other news reporting on a daily basis. But yeah, I had that experience going in.
Well, right. And you had those deadlines. And so, you know, you had to produce. And you know, I didn't have that much experience like you. I mean, I was a cub reporter back in the day. But you know what? I wrote obituaries. First birthdays, I covered school board, city council. Back then I was young. I never knew what the heck was going on, but I still had to sort of pretend it. My editor bloodied my pages. And then I knew that I was doing good when he trusted me. And the first week into the job, and besides writing headlines, he sent me out and to write a feature story. And I knew then it was the feature stories that I would live for occasionally to get to write. Oh, and then he put those on page one with my byline, you know, back when the typewriters, you know, you ran them with coal or wood, you know, wood burning typewriters.
I used to chisel and stone, but we all.
and then, hey, Richard and Bobby, and then throw in, I worked for a small newspaper in Clovis, New Mexico. It was then called the Clovis News Journal. Then we also, the reporters would go out. We didn't have like an official photographer tag. You're it. So you also are the photographer. One time, my boss, Bill, the managing editor, sent me to go cover the county fair. I mean, I'm 19 years old. I'm like, yes, I can do this and go have fun, take pictures of farm animals. I get all the way back to the newspaper, go in the dark room, and there's, you know, we've all been there. No film in the camera.
Kathleen, I just want to interrupt here a second. Chuck Walsh is sending me messages here, and he's been so excited that you were going to be on. Richard, Chuck has been with us, several times on the writer's block. And he's commenting to me that you're doing great, by the way. And also your conversation the two of you just had about writing. He says, y'all are right. It's the hardest thing to write a book, but if it burns within you, you will make the sacrifice. So that's just one of our authors. I wasn't sure I could figure out how to have him call in. So I said, well, just let me know what you're saying. We'll just get it out there.
Chuck, I love you. And I, Sandy, I love Chuck in a writer way. Hi, Chuck. And I respect you as a writer. And I've read one of your books, Black Mingo Creek. I think I got to endorse it. You are the real deal. You work very hard, and your readers love you. Thank you, Chuck, for that, and for and Richard for everything you said too about the process.
And well, he does want you to know that he loves you too, Kathleen.
let's jump tracks and go on process, because there is one question I had regarding this book. I have to preface it with, I read the first two thirds Monday, and I read the final third on Tuesday. And where I stopped, you had it set up where we have kind of learned what really happened that day and that night in 1974 with Dub. She has rekindled an old romance with a high school flame who is now a police detective. And then we have the mysterious person who has defaced a certain grave. Yes. And I'm thinking, okay, you are set now to have the police detective go out, find out what's going on with the defacing of the grave, and that brings him back to Trudy, and and with some knowledge that something happened in 74 and she knows a little bit more about it, and he wants to know. So I'm expecting this big emotional, you know, not really a showdown, but this emotional moment when it all comes out, and now we're going to wonder, is it Detective Clay that's going to respond, or is it boyfriend Clay who's going to respond? And we didn't get that. So I'm kind of wondering, you know, did you see those two possibilities? And if you did, why did you go with the one?
Okay. There is a book club discussion questions in the back of the book. I'm skimming right now. I don't want to give anything away.
I was trying not to do spoilers.
Let me just say this. Clay Cordova, so that's for the listeners. Clay Cordova is a detective. He's a smart guy. Do you think he suspected Trudy was keeping something from him? If so, why didn't he push her to confess her secret? And she was a good cop. So, as a matter of fact, my publisher and agent and I discussed that in this one conference call. And I tried to plant some little, they were very subtle in some of the scenes. I, as the writer, the author, I think Clay kind of was suspicious. But you know what? Trudy left. He didn't see her for 40 years. She comes back. She's the twirler, majorette girl he fell in love with in high school. He doesn't want to lose her. And that's where I left it. I decided other writers would have made it more a police procedural type book. I didn't. And I knew that. I was worried that might be troublesome or problematic. For certain readers, but that's why I included that question in the book book discussions, and I'm glad you pointed that out, Richard.
Well, it wasn't so much problematic for me. It's just that when I read a book as a author, I'm looking, I'm trying to jump ahead and figure out where the author's going. So I kind of thought I knew where you were going with it, and then you went and turned left on me, and I'm like, well, okay, we'll go down this road. But I was kind of wondering if you had mapped out both possibilities, because I did that with one of mine, and there was there was a point where it was two branches. You take this, it's a completely different story. And so I was just wondering if you had that, and why did you pass on doing that one to go the way you did? So I think you pretty much covered that, and we're trying not to do spoilers, so we'll avoid that.
I will just let me just throw that out. This could go for any genre, any book. It goes for real life. There are secrets on top of secrets, and people keep secrets or family secrets. Sometimes they're actually to protect others. Sometimes they're to protect, you know, just a situation. But that's what I'm drawn to, is how much to reveal. What secrets are still kept? What are revealed? And why? Why are secrets kept? Are they kept to be, you know, is it a mean-spirited reason? Is it, you know, there's all kinds of motives for secrets.
Yeah. I think Detective Clay would have probably not done anything given what, what transpired, because, you know, had lived in Texas, New Mexico, and the Midwest for so many years, there's a certain philosophy that seems to hold true through the years with Midwestern folks. When somebody does something like this one person did,
right?
If that person gets their comeuppance, they tend to kind of look the other way and let the person who dealt with the problem have a pass. So
kind of vigilante justice in the old days.
Well, you know, to give you a quick story, and again, it brought me back to 74 because it was such a crazy year for me. We were living in North Dakota, and there was a family who had an abusive husband. And one day he took a pitchfork and pinned his kids through their clothes to the wall of the barn. And mom had enough of that and shot him four times with a shotgun that had to be reloaded every shot.
Did the kids survive?
The kids were fine. He had them pinned. So the sheriff comes out after she calls and tells him what he did. They collect the body. They collect the gun. They get the kids down from the barn. And he tells her, just come in the morning. We'll get your statement. We'll see you tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Doesn't arrest her. The in North Dakota back then, they didn't have county prosecutors. They had to bring somebody from the state in. He's desperately trying to get this thing moved from the city because he knows he's going to lose if it stays there. And it did. They have the trial. The jurors are gathering in the only cafe in town talking about the case and pretty much saying, can they hurry up and get this over with so we can vote her not guilty? And she was voted not guilty. Yeah. So that was kind of that's the Midwest mindset that I grew up with. And so mm-hmm. I think that Clay probably would have been more boyfriend Clay than Detective Clay
Detective Clay.
Yeah, I think Detective Clay might have, said, well, maybe I should or not. But I think it would be more Clay, the boyfriend, going, I'm fine with this.
Yeah.
Well, there'd also been a number of years. Yeah, and there'd also been a number of years that have passed. You know, Clay's getting ready to retire. You know, things would be perhaps perceived. I'm just looking at our clock. Kathleen, we want to get to our one burning question that we always have. Richard, do you want to ask it?
Yeah, I will lay this one on you, Kathleen. We are wanting to know if you have ever been afflicted with that lousy scourge of all writers called writer's block. And if you have, what have you done to drive away that evil demon?
Okay, so I know I've answered this question before in the past, and I didn't cheat and go listen to my answers beforehand. And I think it changes as the writer progresses. Maybe do I believe in writer's block? Yes for some, no for others. For me, anytime if I used to say, oh my God, I have writer's block. Well, at my age now and all the work I've done, for me, it's not, and I'm staring at my writer's block mug that Jim sent me a few years ago. It's not so much that I'm blocked at times. It's that I have made a choice to stop for a little bit to read. A lot of times, that's when I get a lot of my other reading done before I go back to my project. Because once I start writing, I'm all in. I hyper-focus on that. I'm not one of those that can maybe read a novel later in the day and write all day. I'm usually one or the other. So writer's block does exist for some. For others, what I do sometimes, though, when I don't want to get started on it, I'll come in, and I've done this before where I will, we've all heard this, I think, I'll open up and I'll say, I don't know what I'm doing. And years ago, I said to my husband, okay, I'm going to go in the office and I'm going to pretend to be a writer. And here's the key for me. If I pretend to be a writer and I pretend that I know what I'm doing, then it's like dress up when you're a little kid or when you're a little boy playing outside. And it's just like, okay, I'm just going to have fun for a little bit. I'm here just playing. And then the next thing I know, I'm in and it's 5 hours later and I need to, get up out of the chair.
Wow, that's great. That's a great creative response. Let's take Ronan, if you're listening, let's hear a little bit about Creative Edge.
When Creative Edge Publicity was founded in 2016, they immediately showed they weren't the same as other publicity firms. No, they work closely with their individual clients' needs and goals and push harder to get them noticed. Creative Edge believes that communication is an important part of the partnership, and that model is how they have built their success. They collaborate and work with local, national, and international media outlets and organizations to meet their clients' goals and needs. So Creative Edge, it's your brand and your future. Mickey Mickelson, publicist, www.creative-edge.services.
And we're back. Kathleen, I have a question that's sort of out of the ballpark, but I know that you have a number of author friends. Do you find having author friends not only personally satisfying because they're friends, but do you find that having author friends is helpful for you in your writing process?
Yes, I love having a writing community. When I say a writing community, that's writers working at all levels. Published, unpublished, New York Times best-selling authors, people who just have that dream. But what I like to do, and this is one of my biggest things about being a published author, is let's talk about self-promotion. When I promote myself, I try to turn around and help promote others. And that way, the self-promo doesn't feel so icky. But writers, we help each other. And now during the pandemic, and then, of course, Richard, you're a writer. You're helping me out tonight. You're one of the hosts on the show. I think a mutual respect, the mutual admiration society of authors, if you will, we're all in this together. And instead of thinking that it's a competition of, oh my God, well, that writer has sold more books than me. And no, it's like there's enough readers out there in the world. If we all could just come together and help each other, especially now, it would be I think it would make a happier place in the author community. But I love my author friends. They're my go-to when I need to talk story, plot, or I wake up one day and go, I suck. I can't write. Who do I, I've been kidding myself since I was a, teenager. And then I usually send a text. There's a few of them right now. If they're listening, they'll be laughing. But I'll send a text, and then they'll text right back and send me a cheerful, or I'll do the same. It's the give or take.
Yeah, we're starting to call that imposter syndrome, where you start doubting. Yeah, you start doubting whether or not you're really a writer. And I get it from time to time. And I've been writing one way or another since 1983. I'm not an imposter, but you get that feeling sometimes. And it's because because of the work, and it takes so much time, and you have to go out and self-promote. And fortunately, there's a lot of authors who don't look at it as a competition with each other. And there's a lot of us who are doing things to help each other. On my blog, I'm doing something called a Spotlight Sunday, where I interview an author. They just fill out a form, and I post the interview on my blog. That helps that's drive wonderful. Traffic to there. Yeah, that's the kind of things we all need to be doing. And instead of trying to knock that guy off so you can sell more books, let's help everybody sell books.
Mm-hmm. Richard, I love that, what you're doing. That's awesome.
Kathleen, I'm just looking at our time. What are you working on next?
Thank you. I'm working on my fifth novel, speaking of writer's block. I took a few months off, but I'm slowly tiptoeing back in. Because my girls, my characters, have been calling to me. I don't want to give away the working title, but it's another novel set in New Mexico, and it has scenes that take place in the 60s up to the present, and basically it has to do with water or lack of water. Mm. When you grow up in the Southwest, Richard, you lived in New Mexico.
Oh, yeah.
And on the east side where I'm from, unless you were a family and you had means, not everybody had a pool in their backyard. Not everybody joined the country club, and it cost money to go to the public pool. So it's three sisters and two best friends, and they form a secret club when they're little girls. And then something happens to one of the teenagers when they're teenagers. And then later, my main character is Marigold Hubbard, and she's a ghostwriter. But she's never had her name on the cover of a book. Well, girlfriends, come home, and she's going to write a story about what really happened to their friend, Melody.
Ooh. Oh, wow. That sounds fabulous.
You know, Kathleen, you brought up something that reminded me. There's one other question I wanted to toss in real quick. Also, a four-year survivor of Odessa, Texas, and you know what that's like.
But that's the smell of money, Richard.
Yeah, that is the smell of money. But you brought up a first cafeteria reference in this book that we talked about tonight.
Yes.
That brought back so many memories. Yes.
They serve everything but alcohol, and you could get that fish or the banana pudding, right, Richard?
Oh, yeah. So I wanted to mention that I really liked that, because that brought back a lot of the better memories of Odessa, Texas, when I was first cafeteria.
Richard, I'm sorry if Furs was your big highlight.
For Odessa, it was. I'll just put it that way. If you've ever been to Odessa, you would know what I'm talking about. So,
Kathleen, how can
Furs was there a long time ago with Gulf Oil? Go ahead.
How can our listeners get a hold of you, get a hold of your books? You've got a great website. You blog. There's all kinds of stuff there. How do we find you?
You can just Google my name, Kathleen M. Rogers, and it's Rogers with a D, R-O-D-G-E-R-S. Just Kathleen M. Rogers. The latest novel is The Flying Cutterbugs. And, you know, it's like everybody else. It's out there online, everywhere. I've got a website and a blog. I'm on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn.
I have a
Pinterest account, but I'm not real good there. But my go-tos are Facebook and Instagram.
Right. Okay. And just hang with us for another minute, because I picked another piece of music to take the show out. So just stay tuned. We do want to thank everybody for being with us tonight. Next week, Rachel, I'm going to say it's Tomeo. You think it's Tomeo? Richard, our author
I think that's right.
Is Rachel Tomeo, and her book is Carnal Knowledge. And I know Richard's already started it. You may have noticed we're on at a new time. Tonight was the first one. If you listen live, we're now at 6 o'clock p.m. Pacific time. Of course, the podcast goes up shortly after the show, and you can listen at your leisure. And if Ronan has the song Rise queued up, that will take us out tonight. And as our host Jim Christina always says, we are out of here. Enjoy Rise by Herb Alpert.